For Politico, I'm Ryan Heath, and this is Global Insider. What is it about Lithuania? Population 2.8 million, the same as Brooklyn, New York, that makes its people and government so determined to effect change and to stand up for freedom. If you haven't seen the documentary The Jump, the story of Seimas Kudirka, who in 1970 jumped from a Soviet ship onto a US Coast Guard vessel in an attempt to secure his freedom, only to be sent back by the Americans, you really must. It's a tale of national courage, told through the prism of a man and community that could never have imagined what they'd be called on to do, but who never gave up. And in this episode, we'll work our way through a 2022 version of The Jump. The plan by officials in Vilnius to run headlong into the Chinese Communist government and tell them that they recognize Taiwan, that they won't be bullied, that they see in Taiwan their own struggle for freedom from the Soviet Union. Here to tell us all about it is Mantas Adomynas, the architect of the Taiwan policy and Lithuania's Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs. Welcome to Washington. Lithuania's very brave approach to its relationship with Taiwan. Walk us through a little bit the thinking and the strategy behind your decision to really increase your relations with Taipei and to make sure that Lithuania acknowledges Taiwan's right to exist democratically and independently.
In the long perspective, when we think about the future of the global order, this is where most threat and danger comes from. It is a country which is becoming increasingly authoritarian to the point of almost totalitarian sort of level of surveillance, control, suppression of civil society and freedoms and human rights, while at the same time working to subvert the narrative in the international organizations, kind of the UN founding values into something which would accommodate authoritarian and oppressive regimes. You know, when we allowed Taiwan to open its representative office under the name of Taiwan, Taiwanese representative office, we realized the risks that we are facing, but we are bound by our sort of values and principles that we ought to extend this sort of gesture of recognizing Taiwan as Taiwan's dignity as a democratic society. This is, for us, emotionally very recognizable because following the Declaration of Independence in 1990, it was almost a year before we received first sort of formal recognition from Iceland, of all places, which dared, you know, Soviet Union's warships and threats to extend formal recognition to Lithuania.
And that's a really important point. We're just talking about you allowing Taiwan to have an office and to call it what they want to call it. You weren't talking about sending weapons to Taiwan or doing anything of that nature. In many ways, it really was only a symbolic gesture. And yet it causes this huge backlash from Beijing, where they really want to destroy your economy and punish you way out of proportion to allowing an office to exist.
And it still continues. That's important to note that actually this effort still continues, even though it's now overshadowed with this new, very burning challenge of Ukraine. Yes, it was a symbolic gesture, but, you know, sort of looking at what can sort of small countries like Lithuania contribute to the global dialogue and world politics. You know, so clearly we don't have the political, military, economic clout that huge countries like the United States or China do. But on the level of narrative, of shaping the narrative, each voice has the power to carry, and, you know, it can become viral. So we played this role of a sort of canary in the coal mine, alerting the world to the readiness of China to be very aggressive, to use the existing networks of trading and global production, value creation chains as sort of weapons for coercion of political blackmail.
Okay, so now you're a few months into the new policy. Looking at it from this vantage point, what risks stand out? What is your next China challenge?
Our apprehension is that democratic countries tend to be subject to this attention deficit disorder. They cannot concentrate on two things at once, and they cannot concentrate for a long time. So with new burning crisis in Ukraine, we feel that the issue of China is receding, and that there is a tendency to normalize and to think that, oh, well, at least it's not waging an active raging war, so it may be less of a threat. But in the long term, our sort of free world is threatened more by the strategies that China is implementing and attempts to expand its sort of global influence than by this very sort of obnoxious posturing by Russia.
One tactic that autocrats love to use is dividing and conquering amongst Democrats. The fact that we have differences of opinion, that there are boring checks and balances in the system. And I wonder how strong the cross-party thinking is to hold this line around China.
So I will not pretend that it's a sort of universally agreed fact, this take on revising relations with China and extending greater support to democracy in Taiwan has been universally accepted. And so at the moment, yes, it is very much debated. But what I'm confident of is that, first of all, the development of events in the world shows that the current government's principled stance on Taiwan and China is getting broader and broader recognition globally in the free world, in the democratic world. And in a sense, while we went out of the kind of accepted, accustomed territory and struck out our flags, but now the map is shifting and the global opinion is moving in the same way. And I think the war in Ukraine and China's role in it will have shown to the Lithuanian public and to Lithuanian political elites that we were right in having this apprehension about the global role that China is playing. But of course, the support and solidarity of other democracies such as Australia, US, Canada, Japan is extremely important to us. And we do feel sort of this very strong shoulder from the community of democratic nations.
So thinking about what the West allowed Russia to do and the way it allowed the kleptocrats of Russia to exist in their spaces, to buy their properties, to make money through trade ties. Is there a lesson we have to take away from these failures in our management of Russia that we have to plug into what you're doing around China and Taiwan?
Absolutely. The danger is that we will look at the sanctions we adopted against oligarchs and say, okay, well, we've done our bit. And when the crisis and the war against Ukraine is over, we'll go back to the previous mode of existence. So we have an opportunity now to create immunity, to create an ecosystem which is immune to Russian oligarchs, to the united front of China. The present war would not have happened if Gerhard Schröder had not betrayed the interests of the free world for his personal financial gain. And there were many Schröders of smaller caliber in the intervening years.
And they're all over China.
And they're all over China. And the sort of to safeguard, in a sense, the integrity of our political decision-making, we have to take these lessons very deep to heart. It's not just a kind of, you know, sanctions as a passing sort of stage, but they have to install a new culture of relating to the financial ideological interests coming from authoritarian societies.
I love that concept of immunity. And I think in larger countries, including my own, Australia, there's been very well-funded Chinese efforts where I wouldn't call it misinformation, but I would call it the planting of ideological seeds so that it softens a community up to China's interests and blinds you to some extent to what is really going on or what is really wanted by Beijing. But I'm not sure what it's like in a smaller country like Lithuania, where the Confucius Institutes and other properties connected to the Chinese state ever got to the Baltic countries to try and do the same things that they've been trying in America and Australia and so on.
They didn't manage to catch on the academia. In a sense, the information effort by China has been wrong-footed on many levels by society's resistance to the concept. And there were few willing takers of the funds, as it were. But to return to our bigger issue, I think that we have to really sort of engage very seriously with the effort that both China and Russia are doing on the sort of narrative level. And the coalescence of the two revisionist authoritarian superpowers, Russia is sort of extremely creative, proactive, and mischievous role in sort of promoting conspiracy theories and creating and facilitating the creation of these conspiratory-minded networks. China is much more subtly shift the underlying value concepts and their content, you know. So instead of talking about human rights, they sort of start talking about everyone wants development, but when development becomes the criterion of progress as opposed to democratic values, then we are sort of, you know, we are creating an alternative universe where tyrannies can justify themselves saying that, you know, we are implementing UN Millennium Goals. The Russian aggression in Ukraine shows to which degree this can become a political danger with a mad dictator and a totally brainwashed population which sort of subscribes to his visions. And this is an explosive situation.
And somehow we still have to appeal to that population.
Yes, exactly.
Because he won't leave until he dies if some of that population can't be convinced to rise up against him.
Exactly. And this is a very hard task, given the way that Russians are learning very rapidly from the Chinese how to block the information sphere of Russia from any outside sort of voices. But it's not just a matter of providing an alternative source of information, but it's also actively engaging in defending the democratic narrative. And we've missed 3 decades, in a sense. What is happening in Ukraine, it could have been averted in many episodes by granting sort of membership action plan in 2008, by sort of being much more resolute. And we allowed this KGB revanchist to grab back.
There are several ways to look at how the Baltics and Poland went on one path and Ukraine ended up on another after the Cold War. And some say, oh, well, they were so lucky to have this great leadership at this moment. And then the Ukrainians were so unfortunate to be stuck with this corrupt elite and weak institutions. I want to give you more credit in Lithuania and in your neighboring countries for the hard work of building up those institutions. And I wonder, what can we do now when the fighting is over to help Ukraine catch up quicker, to modernize, to be able to integrate and be a real EU member and not a charity case that we just handed a membership card to because of what Russia did to them?
Of course, we will need to help Ukraine with economic rebuilding. But if the spirit of resistance and the spirit of national mobilization sort of continues into the peaceful efforts, I see no heights that Ukraine cannot climb.
Thank you so much for being a Global Insider.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Weidong Lin produces this show. Our executive producer of audio is Jenny Arment. I'm Ryan Heath. Subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. We'll be back next Wednesday with another episode of Global Insider.